Well, let's get started. We like to start on time here, as is our custom. Good evening and welcome to the second presentation in this, our 16th series of talks on faraway places with strange-sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our facilities coordinator, Daniel Peach, back there taking pictures, and our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Patrick Peters designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pauly. Our speaker tonight is a native of Newark, New Jersey, and attended the State University of New York, Stony Brook, from where she received her PhD in philosophy in 1982. She expanded her doctoral research in her first book, The Flight to Objectivity, Essays on Cartesianism and Culture, published in the SUNY Series in Philosophy in 1987, which has become a classic of feminist philosophy. In 1993, the University of California Press published her Unbearable Weight, Feminism, Western Culture, and the Body, which has been widely cited and discussed in scholarly writings and used in courses in a variety of disciplines. It was a New York Times notable book of 1993 and nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. It was the first book to draw attention to the role of cultural images in the spread of eating problems across race and class. In 1999, her book, The Male Body, A New Look at Men in Public and Private, was published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. It's been described as a personal cultural exploration of the male body from a woman's point of view, and it's one of the first books in the then emerging field of masculinity studies, and it was featured in Mademoiselle, Elle, Vanity Fair, and on NPR and MSNBC. Her other books, like Twilight Zones, The Hidden Life of Cultural Images from Plato to O.J., and Feminist Interpretations of René Descartes, have been widely read, and her articles like Gay Men's Revenge, Reading the Slender Body, and My Father the Feminist have been reprinted many times. A member of the faculty at the University of Kentucky, she's professor of gender and women's studies and holds the prestigious Otis A. Singletary Chair in the Humanities. In recent years, she's focused her research on one of the wives of Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, which culminated in her new book, The Creation of Anne Boleyn, A New Look at England's Most Notorious Queen, which the New York Times called engrossing, blending biography, cultural history, and literary analysis. Please give a warm welcome to Susan Bordo. Susan?
Thank you, Brian. So thanks so much for having me, and thanks for all of you for coming out. It's a great, nice, packed hall here at Barnes & Noble. I'm going to start out by giving you guys a little quiz, and I have a prize. For the one who gets the answer, this is the UK edition of the book, which actually there's a very interesting story attached to it in the question and answer period. I might be able to get into it. There are differences between the UK version and the US version. And the reason why there are, well, that's a story that we can go into. But what I brought as the door prize for the person who gets the answer to this quiz is the UK edition, and I will sign it. So, what I will ask is that the people in the audience who are experts in any way in Tudor history, whether you are an amateur Tudor history buff or a teacher, not participate in this. This comes from... Oh. I don't think I touched it. Okay, this comes from an internet site called interestingfact.com. Or it did. And my question for you all is, which of these interesting facts about Anne Boleyn is actually a fact? First person to get the answer right gets the book. Yes?
None.
Not true.
No.
Oh.
Good try.
Yes.
She was reputed to have six fingers and always wore gloves.
And is that true or false?
I believe it to be true because I've never heard of her hands.
Wrong. It's false. And I'll talk about it in a minute. Yes?
She had an extra nipple.
Excuse me?
She had an extra nipple.
No.
She was executed.
That is one fact that is correct.
Not with the knife.
That is true. Actually, that isn't one of the facts, but it is kind of a visual error there because she wasn't executed with a knife or a hatchet, which was often the case in Tudor England, and sometimes took several strokes to get the head off. She was actually beheaded with an elegant French sword. So one of the facts is she was executed, not with a knife, but with a sword. What else is factual here? So far, who was the one who said she was executed? Okay, so far you are the winner, so far.
She was tried for witchcraft.
False.
Adultery.
Adultery is true. She was one of Henry VIII's six wives. Okay, there are only two facts here that are true. One is that she was indeed one of Henry VIII's six wives. And here we've got some visual representations of the six wives. Children in the United Kingdom learn who the wives are by means of a little chant. Divorced, beheaded, survived. Beheaded, divorced, died. That's the way kids in the UK keep track of Henry's wives and what happened to them. I included the little cartoon there to give you a visual representation of what some scholars think is the reason why they all, or nearly all of them, met such inglorious ends. Namely, Henry was kind of nuts. And indeed was executed. And, you know, just an array of representations, some of which are factual. The one up in the upper right-hand corner, there is a sword there. But you can see that some of them are not. The two with the hatchet are incorrect. Now, I don't know how to split the prize, because somebody got the six wives and somebody got the fact that she was executed. But I'm sure we can figure out a way to do it if you two come up afterwards. What?
Give it to six.
Give it to six wives? Okay. I've got it for you after. She was not tried for witchcraft. She was tried for adultery, incest, and treason. Was she guilty of any of these? Even today, some people, including a historian here and there, believe this. The fact is, however, that the overwhelming number of the sexual encounters of which Anne was accused not only could not be proved, but would have been virtually impossible because she was either pregnant or recovering from being pregnant, or she was away on progress with Henry. That is, she was traveling around to various other kingdoms at the time she was supposed to have slept with the other men. The most she appears to have been guilty of is some overly flirtatious chatter with the men in her court, which was tweaked into treasonous talk by Thomas Cromwell. Now, some of you have seen the recent BBC production of Wolf Hall or have read Wolf Hall. Well, I'll just assume that some of you have, some of you haven't. But it's a revisioning of Thomas Cromwell, who has usually been thought of as one of the chief villains in the plot that was cooked up to convict Anne and have her executed. Hilary Mantel revisions it so that she paints a Cromwell who is far less mean and scheming than the Cromwell that we're used to. But many historians believe that, in fact, Anne was guilty of no acts of adultery, no acts of treason, certainly no incest, and that it was, in fact, the equivalent of a coup d'etat. She did not have an extra nipple or six fingers on one hand, on both hands, let alone on one hand, let alone both hands. How do we know this? Well, we know this for, there's different ways of showing this to be the case. The bodies at the chapel of Peter ad Vincula, which is where Anne and a number of other famous Tudors were buried, have been exhumed. And even though it's unclear whose bones are whose, none of the bones on any of the hands have an extra digit. Okay, that's one piece of evidence for the fact that she did not have six fingers. Another piece of evidence is that none of her enemies, even those who wrote exhaustively about all of her flaws at the time she was alive, mentioned six fingers on her hand. And they surely would have had it been the case. And a little bit later, I'm going to talk about one of the most famous of those enemies, who is responsible for a lot of the mythology surrounding Anne Boleyn. And finally, there's a very compelling reason, quite apart from any kind of empirical evidence, for why we can be pretty sure that Anne did not have six fingers on her hand. Anybody know what that would be? Anybody want to guess what that would be? Physical deformities nowadays are interpreted differently than physical deformities were then. And physical deformities then were thought of as signs that Satan had a hand in the conception of the child who was born with the deformity. There is no way that had Anne had six fingers, even though it's really quite common. You know, nowadays, doctors just kind of tie a string around the sixth finger and allow it to drop off. There's no way that Henry would have accepted Anne, was that a little too gross there? would have accepted Anne as a lady-in-waiting, let alone his consort, if she had had a six finger. Not because it's so grotesque, which is how it's often portrayed in representations of the story, but because it would have been a sign that Satan had influence in her conception, probably by copulating with her mother. What she does seem to have had, according to George White, who was the grandson of one of Anne's admirers, Thomas White, who wrote poetry, presumably about her, was a tiny vestigial nail, which was so small by the report of those that have seen her as to be easily hidden by the tip of one of her other fingers. So the question is, how did that vestigial nail become a sixth finger? The answer is to be found in a book called The Rise and Growth of the Anglican Schism, written by Nicholas Sander in 1585. Notice that this is well after Anne died, right? She was executed in 1536. This is 1585. Nicholas Sander was an exiled Catholic polemicist, and I'm going to talk a little bit later on about why that's important in terms of the various myths that have grown up around Anne Boleyn. Exiled by Elizabeth, Anne's daughter, hated all things Boleyn, hated all things Protestant, and Anne, although there wasn't any such thing as Protestantism when Anne was alive, she did believe in ideas that later were to develop into Protestantism, and spread the most lurid ideas about the family, what they looked like, the kind of behavior they were engaged in, described Anne Boleyn as rather tall of stature, with black hair and an oval face of sallow complexion, as if troubled by jaundice, not exactly Natalie Dormer, eh? She had a projecting tooth under her upper lip and on her right hand, six fingers. This is the first mention we get anywhere of six fingers by a man who had never seen her. There was a large wen under her chin, and therefore, to hide its ugliness, she wore a high dress covering her throat. I added a picture of Anne, quite a famous portrait, hanging in the National Portrait Gallery in London to show that Nicholas Sander, you may say many, many things about him. This is probably the most innocuous of them. He didn't have very much knowledge of fashion during the Tudor era, because though high necks were in fashion during the period in which he lived, Elizabethan collars and the like, they were not in fashion then. So she, you know, if she had a large wen on her neck, what her dress certainly would not have hidden it. You can judge Sander's credibility by a couple of other things that he says about Anne. He claims, among other things, besides having slept with most of her father's friends and most of the French court, he claims that she, now I always get this wrong, she was the daughter, the child of Henry VIII and her own mother. So, yeah. Now, what is really kind of extraordinary is when we went around the room to begin with, how many of the ideas that someone like Nicholas Sander created, really out of whole cloth, have stuck. It's not that you guys are particularly ill-informed. These ideas, the finger, the nipple, elsewhere Sander talks about the nipple, the being tried for witchcraft, which she was not, but somebody like Sanders certainly describes her in ways that are very witch-like. Talked about her as having very, very dark black hair, and probably didn't have dark black hair. She had a kind of darkish auburn hair, according to the National Portrait Gallery and some of the other early portraits of her. But these ideas have stuck. They've stuck so fast that you still see articles in magazines about Anne's sixth finger, right? There's an article that I refer to in the book that appeared in a magazine, and the point of the article was, if you have something wrong with yourself physically, it was addressed to teenagers, don't feel ashamed of it, because some of the most beautiful women in the world were deformed too. Anne Boleyn had a sixth finger. Or some of you might remember the scene in Steel Magnolias, where they're talking through the bathroom door at Truvy's Beauty Salon, and one of them is sitting on the toilet reading a magazine, I forget which one, and she yells out, "Hey, don't you know that Anne Boleyn had six fingers?" It's a sedimented, entrenched piece of mythology that we just do not let go of. The idea that Anne is a witch, there are still festivals in Spain that have floats in which a figure that is supposed to represent Anne Boleyn is depicted as a monster. This is just a funny little thing I put up there. Right, to show how these associations of Anne Boleyn as a witch survive even in heavy metal groups. In actual fact, we know very little about Anne Boleyn. She wasn't royal.